You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
This is rock and roll. Time to rock it from the Delta to the DMZ. Is that me or does that sound like an Elvis Presley movie? Viva Da Nang. Oh, Viva Da Nang. Da Nang me, why don't they get a rope and hang me? Hey, is this a little too early for being that loud? Hey, too late. It's 0600. What's the O stand for? Oh, my God, it's early.
And whatever comes our way, yeah, darling, go make it happen. Take the world in a loving place. Fire all of the guns that come down, explode into space. I like smoking lightning. Heavy metal thunder, racing with the
solving a technical issue right now, so bear with me, please.
Yeah, darling, go make it happen. Take the world in a loving grace. Fire all of your guns at once and explode into space. Like a true nature child, we were born to be wild.
Oh, my God. Joining me now is the man, the myth, the legend himself, Pete Kimball Holmes. What's up?
Hey, another day in paradise, baby. It's warm, beautiful, 55 degrees, going up, baby.
And, you know, people have no idea how technologically challenged you are. And the fact that you're on Skype at all is a minor miracle. So,
no question. I admit. I'm lame.
No, you're not lame. It's just, you know, it's not everybody's thing, man. It's not everybody's thing. And so we're just solving a little Skype issue. I've got an email, that somebody sent me.
I've been waiting for emails.
Well, somebody sent me this, just a few minutes ago. It said, when the chef comes on, here you go. When Kim comes on, ask him how he decided to go to Italy and Switzerland to study cooking.
That's a great question.
It is a great question, isn't it?
I went over with a round-trip ticket on Icelandic Airlines in 1970.
Okay, hold on. So 1970, what is your level of experience at this point? Do you have a lot of experience, not a lot of experience? Where are you in life?
I've cooked. I had went to a vocational culinary school.
You?
In Washington, D.C.
Hello.
Hello, can you hear me?
I can. I was said hello, like testify.
Oh, okay. And then I was going back out to California and with some friends in a converted milk truck, and we were in Ann Arbor, Michigan for the Ann Arbor Blues Festival in August of 74. And one of the people that we knew was doing security for the Blues Festival, and they asked me, do you want to be backstage security? So I met all my favorite blues people. And during that time, I had a passport that was 2 years old and I hadn't used it. And I said, you know what? I'm not going to California. I've been there. I've done that. I'm going to go to Europe. I sold my guitar, hitchhiked back to New York, got myself ready to go, had a backpack, weighed about 35 pounds, and I bought a ticket on Icelandic Airlines round trip, and I had about $320, and I was helping my sister move to a new apartment in New York City, and I got my brother's car towed, and it cost me $100 to get it out of Holland in 1970. That's a lot of money back then.
Getting your car towed is such a ripoff. I won't even go into it. But Kim and I got involved, and I had no idea what a scam that car towing was until somebody called me one day when I was doing my radio show in North Dakota live on the air and said, I got my car towed, and when I went to get it, they told me if I wanted it back that I had to pay them $250. And I said, what? And this blew up into something that was a huge story. And it's essentially a criminal enterprise. But I feel for you, bro. I feel for you.
And anyway, I only had $220. And everybody's saying, well, we'll see you for Thanksgiving. This was October 4th I took off. I said, F you guys. I'm going over. I'm going to get a job. I don't care where. I'm just going to find a job. But I'm going to hitchhike down to Spain and weather the winter in Spain and get a job in a hotel or a restaurant.
You have it.
I didn't speak Spanish. So I got going, and I went over by myself, got to the youth hostel, and I said, and some guys were hitching to the Oktoberfest, the end of Oktoberfest in Munich. I said, well, why not? So I took off. A couple of days, I was down to about $150.
Uh-oh.
I says, uh-oh. So I took off for Spain. I got to Genoa, Italy, and I stood with me, and I guess I weighed about 235 then, and me and my backpack, and all the cars are Cinquecentes, those little Fiat 500s, about the size of a coffee table.
Right.
And I couldn't get a ride. So I went back to the youth hostel the first night. I stayed 12 hours on the side of the road and went back, and then went out again the next morning. Nobody picked me up. I went back, and they said, well, they're hiring in Switzerland in the hotels for the winter season. So I says, I'm there. So I took off.
Okay, let me ask you a question. So there's no work requirements?
I'll get to that.
Okay. All right. Sorry.
I got to the youth hostel in Geneva, Switzerland.
Okay.
And they said, oh, they're hiring in Vangen or Grindelwald, where the Eiger Mountain is, where they filmed the Eiger section. And so I took off, got a ride there, went up to the youth hostel, got a room, and started looking for jobs. All the jobs were taken. So I says, uh-oh. And I'm down to about $50. And my friend, who I met there, Michael Monaco, he was running out of money. We didn't want to leave. It's the middle of October and, or towards the end of October. And so they said, okay, I found out that the, guy who was running the youth hostel, for his father was, they call him wardens there, he was born on March 22nd, 1944. Yeah. So I talked my way. I said, I got to go home, and I'm not going home. You got to give me a job. Well, we have a retaining wall to build in the backyard. It was terraced. So I says, I know concrete work. I worked at my dad's concrete block plant growing up.
Yeah.
And so they put me to work. I got room and board. About maybe a couple bucks a day, and I was living the life, and so I worked there until after Christmas, and the job had run out, and they got me a job in the across the on the other side of the mountain in Vangen, Switzerland. So I went over there, and the train goes from Grindelwald up to Kleine Scheide, and then down the other side to Vangen, and then down to the valley floor. And this village was spectacular, sat on the edge of the Alps, only accessible by foot or cog train. Everything was electric. All the carts were electric. So they got me a job on the ice rink. And I says, well, okay,
you know what? Look, well, you know what I think? People were thinking that you said, well, you know, when you study food, okay?
Yeah. I'm getting there.
when you study food.
It takes me a while.
No. But people, this sounds like a Marine Corps story. This does, the only thing that you didn't do is, hey, this is a no shitter, okay? Because, like, yeah. It has all the same elements. No money, bad decisions, like hanging your ass out. Yeah. This is awesome. I love this.
Yeah. So I drove the Zamboni on the ice rink and learned about curling and all that stuff. The job ended a couple weeks after Easter. I had met this girl skiing, and she says, well, why don't you come visit me in Florence? I live in Florence. I'm going to school there. Oh, yeah, hell yeah. So myself and two Canadian ski instructors jumped in their microbus. We're driving down to Italy. I got my orange flight suit on, with a big Yank flag on the back that I always hitchhiked in. And the engine blew up on the, they call them autostradas over there, the freeway, about an hour outside of Florence. So I ended up, we just took the license plates off the car, got all our stuff, and went to the train station. Went into Florence, went up, met Lisica and Fiesole, and so we were hanging out there, and I'm having a great time in this little restaurant called Pizzeria Trattoria Etrusca, which means ancient, and the lady that ran it was Lola Boca, affectionately known as Mama Lola. And we hit it off great, Mama Lola and I. And she was determined to teach me Italian. So I went to her about a month later. I said, Lola, I've got to hitchhike back. I got to go home. I don't have any money. And this is about a week before Easter. And she looks at me and she says, "We'll get you a job. You can't leave." And we're kind of, she's speaking in Italian and it's being translated for me. So I went to work on Easter Sunday at Mama Lola's and as a waiter to start. And not a word of Italian. So I go out to the table, speak a little bit of, take the order. And she wouldn't let me write anything down. Then I came back to her, told her what I thought I heard. She'd laugh, pinch my cheek, run out to the table, and explain this stupid American wants to live in Italy and is trying to learn Italian. What's your order? So they gave her the order, and she made a joke, and they're all looking over their shoulders at me, standing by the door looking stupid. And Lola come back. She repeat the order to me. Then I would repeat it to her and then repeat it to the cook, and I spoke perfect menu in a month and could make change and everything. Then I went to Dante Alighieri, a language school in Florence, took the bus number 7 down to Piazza San Marco and walked to school about 3 days a week, and then 4 days a week, and then 5 days a week. And in 3 months, I was fluent. And so I went up, and when the pizza maker was off and the cook was off, I'd sub and do prep work and stuff like that, and wait table and tend the bar. I learned how to make a Negroni and do all kinds of bars. Just sucking up everything, asking questions like crazy. And Lola was such a wonderful woman. And so I met this guy from California. And
wait a minute, but and, so hold on. I thought Mama Lola was in Italy.
She is. She's in Italy.
But
I tell you,
you meet her in Switzerland.
No, I met her in Italy. I hitchhiked. I went with two ski instructors in a microbus down to Florence.
Okay. All right.
You got it?
I got it.
Okay. Then I worked there for about a year, and when David got sick. In the meantime, we did the Bead Quest to North Africa, to Morocco, Sahara Desert. We don't get into that. And came back to Europe. I didn't go back to Italy to work. I went back to Wangen. And they said I could get a job at the Brunner Hotel.
Right.
But I had to start out as a porter.
Right. That's the hotel is where the tequila story comes from, right?
Yes.
Right.
Yes.
See, I know these.
And then I ended up working there for 3 years. So a year in Italy, 3.5 years in Switzerland. I flew home a couple of times because I'd saved money.
Don't you need a visa or anything? You just like roll over there and work?
Yeah. Well, in Switzerland, they have the country issues so many guests. They're called Gastarbeiters, guest worker permits to the hotels.
Ah.
And then you get the job. Then you had to go to Brig, which is on the Italian border in that part of Switzerland. Get a chest x-ray to make sure you didn't have tuberculosis.
Of course.
And then you could come back and you could work. And, you go to the, police station, turn in your passport, and then when you left the country, they gave you your passport back. And for 4 years, you were allowed to work 9 months a year in country and you had to leave for 3 months, which was perfect for me.
Right.
Because I had worked the seasons there, summer and winter, and I'd vacation in Italy and Spain.
And so for the 3 months, for the 3 months, you didn't go back to the U.S. You just went around Europe.
Oh hell yes, yeah, absolutely, and that's how I got my chops in the kitchen, working, you know, starting doing the grunt work in the kitchen. Whatever they wanted me to do, if they wanted me to scrub the floors, I did. Wash pots and pans, peel carrots, potatoes, and then I get to do a little backup stuff and make certain things and ask questions, and they show me how to do this and that. And that's where we learned the Swiss Tiger beef.
Right.
And that's,
so this whole thing is a big accident. This, your whole career is a big accident.
Yeah. Well, no, I started in high school working, flipping burgers in a beer bar.
Right.
In Palo Alto.
Right.
And my first job actually was, I lasted about 2 weeks, was washing, dishes in a retirement home. Where you had to climb into the soup kettle with a wire brush and a scraper.
What?
And, yeah, they were big. They didn't have tip kettles back in the 60s. You had to take a little step ladder and climb in them. But then I got a job, I went down to, Mexico on spring break and, then, came back and got a job in a little, beer bar. That served great hamburgers. And that's how I started my career. And I've been in it since, all the way up until I sold Sanders in, 5 years ago.
What? So,
4 years.
So, okay. So let's go back to you just mentioned that they made great burgers. What made their burgers great?
They were cooked on a flat griddle.
Okay. A lot of people do that.
Greasy, juicy, beautiful.
Right.
And simple, real simple. A local bakery made these rectangular buns, and we had a lot of Stanford kids in there, and I just had a great time doing it.
So what made their burgers great, though? Just it was greasy? A lot of grease?
You know, good meat. Cheeseburgers and
good cheese. All right. I just wondered if there was
onions, raw onions. They didn't fry them then. Right.
If there was some secret ingredient that they, you know, that they put Worcestershire sauce or something in the meat or
salt and pepper your burger and that's it. Real simple, and don't overcook them. Right. No Bismarck press, baby.
Bismarck Press. The another question. So as long as we're talking about Kim's education, who was the greatest influence on him as a professional chef?
Well, it would happen long before that. If I would have to say my greatest influence in Europe, it would have been Mama Lola in Italy. She taught me a lot about pasta and doing different dishes in a wood-fired oven. But my biggest, greatest influence that got me started was my grandmother, who wrote a food editor. She was a food editor for Ladies' Home Journal.
That's big shit, man. I'm not going to lie to you.
Her husband was an industrial designer in New York City and designed all the interiors to Boeing airplanes. And so when I was hanging out and they had a farm in New Jersey, he was a gentleman farmer kind of. He had somebody run the farm and they raised everything and ate all their own stuff. But she would do an article for the magazine, her summer article, at the farm, and I would be around for that, and she would pick the herbs, show me how to do herbs, what they smelled like, what they, she made me eat everything. And that's how I got my chops as far as being interested in food and cooking. And I always did all the cooking, when I was around my friends and stuff. I just liked it. I loved it. I just had to figure out how to get paid for this shit.
What's the luckiest break you ever got in your career? Because you know what? Careers are made. A lot of time there's an element of timing involved. There's meeting somebody who opens a door for you. And so you look at the path of successful people. And one of the things they talk about is not quitting. And, you know, I should, and they'll tell you stuff like, I should have quit here, but I didn't.
Yeah.
And because I didn't quit, I met this guy. And then this guy introduced me or opened the door to this. And after that happened, I never looked back. There is an element of, a friend of mine would call it providence.
Yes.
Others would call it luck.
Divine providence.
There you go. And people, my friend, he's Italian. His name's Chris Bronzi. And he tells me, Mac, providence, I'm telling you. It's providence. I'm like, Bronzi. But, so what is the biggest break you ever, you think you ever got in your life?
I think the biggest break was going when I came back to visit David in California. And then I said, I think I'm going to go back to work in Vengen. I didn't want to go back to Italy at this time. And so, I knew this guy in Vengen who ran a discotheque, this English guy. And I called him and I said, hey, are there any jobs in Vengen? He says, by the way, there's two jobs left. One is at the Brunner Hotel, which is about a quarter of a mile. All the ski trails come down to the village, to the station. They go behind this hotel. And there's the hotel at Vengenalp, which is halfway up, but the last train up to the hotel, and you can't walk it in the winter. I mean, you can, but it takes hours, and not at 2 o'clock in the morning, and when the bars close. And that's the only one I know of. And so I took the Brunner job, and the lady who managed the hotel for her father, who's still alive at the time, was Margaret Brunner. And she gave me my break. And she put me through the paces. I worked as the concierge. You go down, you pick up people at the station, and she let me wear my cowboy hat. And everybody from hotels over there at the time, they all had, the porters, all had little hotel uniforms. Well, Margaret and her family lived in Oregon for a year. They were going to maybe be a cattle rancher. And you had to be too big. So they leased their hotel out and then came back the next year. So she spoke English and she liked Americans. So we hit it off, and I was the first Yank to work in that village ever. And so she let me do the porter job, and I got to paint the electric cart bright orange with Lou Brunner letters and wear my orange flight suit and wear my cowboy hat down to the station. And they would always say, well, you know, look for the cowboy with the orange suit. And so they'd pile off the train and you know, you're from the Brunner, yeah, oh yeah, let's go. And I'd pile the luggage up and there'd be a couple of seats and somebody, two people would sit beside me, and I'd take that electric cart up the hill, unload it, and the hall porter would pick the bags up, take them up to the rooms, And then I'd go upstairs and check the people in. And then if they needed help in the kitchen, I'd go down and peel vegetables or clean. And they kept me real busy. And during the high season, which was, the first from the Lauberhorn downhill race, that's a ski race, on the World Cup circuit at the end of January. From there until Easter, it was high season. And you worked 7 days a week. You got no time off.
What is high season?
And high season means everything is full.
Okay.
And all cylinders are running on all the hotels. There's no rooms. And you're just lucky to be there.
Got it.
And
all this happens because they need help with concrete and of your experience at your dad's concrete block place.
That's right. And oh, God, that's awesome. A great story. I mean, I mixed it all by hand. You know, they pull this, truck would come up to their driveway, dump this gravel sand mixture. I'd put it in a long line, a peaked line. Then I'd take my shovel and I'd make a line down the middle, a little trough.
Right.
And I'd put the dry concrete cement in there. And then you start at one end. And then you, two people, one on each side. And you turn the concrete and the gravel together. Then you turn it back and you do that. Then you'd put a line down and you do water and then you mix it and you mix, maybe a third, a quarter of it. And then you put it in a wheelbarrow and then you took it down the hill and, and they had this 2x6 set up going down the hill and then you had to make a right turn and wheel it in along and dump it. But before that, I had to dig the frickin' ditch for the footer wall. And I did that. And then once I got that, all the rocks were sitting along the side. And they said, okay, it's time for you to wash the rocks. I said, what do you mean wash the rocks? He says, that's why buildings last 300-400 years in Europe. Not like America where you got to build them every 20 years. And so I had a big scrub brush and a 5-gallon bucket of water and washed all the rocks. And then anyway, the man came along, the owner, and laid the bricks, laid the stones. But yeah, that's what got me hooked in Switzerland. And then I went back and got a job at the Brunner. And then I got into serious cooking my second and third year working there. And plus, I started the Brunner Bar. And you have to have a certificate to do anything in Switzerland. So before the second year, Margaret sent me to Zurich for 2 weeks to bartending school. Well, I knew how to mix drinks, but I said, sure. So room, you know, they gave me a room and a per diem, and I was there for 2 weeks. I came back, and starting the bar up, I said, hey, can we get tequila in here, Herr Brunner? He says, sure, I'll get you. How many bottles do you want, he says. I said, oh, I'll start with a case. He looked at me, he says, son, this hotel's been here since 1907. We've never sold a case of anything in its history. I said, well, we're going to sell some tequila, I'm pretty sure. And he just looked at me and says, 3 bottles. I said, okay. So there's a system. You buy the bottles from the hotel. You have these drink stubs. You go, one goes on a spindle. and one stays in your book. And then at the end, you match up the, you have 17 drinks in a bottle of tequila or any booze, and they give you, you pay for 15 drinks. That's how much the bottle costs, whatever the drink price was, times. And you got two drinks, the two shots to play with. And so he didn't believe me. I said, it's only been 3 days and you need more tequila? I said, Herr Bruner, I told you I needed a case. He says, ah, rah, 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 rah. So I had to take my book down to the cage where I got the liquor. He matched everyone. He's shaking his head. He says, I'll get you six bottles. I said, Herr Bruner, I'm going to need a case. He laughed at me and he said, okay, I'll get you six bottles. So a week later, I said, Herr Bruner, I'm down to one bottle of tequila. I need a case of tequila. He says, I'll get you a goddamn, and Margaret steps in and says, Dad, buy the man a case of tequila, for God's sakes. Look how much tequila he sold. And he says, okay. He says, but any tequila left, you're going to have to buy him, buy the tequila. I said, I gladly do it. And I went through, I think, the first winter, 10 to 12 cases of tequila. And I had, you know, those glass boots, that they drink German beer out of?
Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Okay, you're aware of
them. I've seen them.
Well,
pictures of them.
I filled mine full of Tequila Sunrise.
What?
And I had ski schools coming down, and they'd stop, and they wanted a boot. Give us a boot. And they'd all buy beers, chasers. And they drink this boot. And the last one, the first one that splashes himself with the Tequila Sunrise, because there's a technique to drinking it to slowly turn the toe. Otherwise, an air pocket gets in there and shoots the liquid all over your face. Had to pay for it. And that's okay with me because it means that they less for them to drink, but they got good at it. So the last, then they changed it to the last person drinking had to buy the boot. And that was so much fun. But that was really something. I sold a lot of shots with beer backs. Yeah, and there was no tequila in Vengen. And after my third year there, there's 26 bars in that town, and they all had tequila on the shelf.
Mr. Tequila.
Yeah.
Here's an email for you. Mac, what a hoot. What a great career that happens on a trip to Europe. He mentioned Eiger beef.
Yeah.
And I believe he was alluding to prime rib. Is there any difference between the way he learned to make it in Switzerland and the way it's made here in the United States? Interesting question.
Well, that's a great question. Over there, they use top rounds, bottom rounds. They did big roast beefs. And they would dress the roast beef that night, and then they'd slow cook it all day for supper that night. And that seasoning blend that you all have, Bob and I thought, would this be great on roast beef, on prime rib? And we thought, because prime rib was the king over here for years. Wow. I just thought, and Bob and I agreed that this would be dynamite on prime rib. And that's how that got started. And because I lived in Switzerland near the Eiger Mountain and, you know, the movie, Eiger Sanction and all that stuff.
Right.
We call it Swiss Eiger beef.
Nice.
You get a mountain of beef was our line. And that's how that came about. but they didn't do prime ribs like we do over here. They did rounds, big roasts that they could do a lot of things. Like they would the first night would be sliced roast beef, and they'd slice it thin and it'd be rare, medium rare, and then they do like maybe beef rouladen, which is you take a slice of beef, you take a pickle and mustard and diced minced onions, you roll them up, you put a toothpicks in them, then you put them in a gravy, you cook them for an hour and a half or so, and then you serve a couple of those with potatoes and vegetable. Or they do a stew. They chop it up and make a stew out of the pieces. They made like probably three dinners out of one big steamship round. You know, the round weighed 20 pounds, for right. Christ's sakes. It's a big sucker.
But that's how you stay in business, right?
Yeah, you utilize. And that's another thing I learned. You use everything. You improv. Like with me and my roast caraway duck, I would do those, and then if I had any duck left over, I would make a duck salad with the prairie sauce as a part of the antipasto plate. So, you know, you use everything. You know how it is, Mac.
No, I don't. Yeah. But, I mean, that's how, you know, again.
That's how you utilize everything. You make money off of money. And that's how you good restaurateurs do it.
No, it is interesting. Here's another question. Mac, I'm curious, if Kim were to think back about what is the main dish of Switzerland, what is it? I've never been there.
Okay, it's a veal dish.
What?
With mushrooms in like a creamy, it looks kind of like a cream sauce, not white, but with the beef stock and the cream, it turns it kind of brown. And they serve that a lot. Or they would do, like Germany, they'll do schnitzel is popular. But I would say, the most iconic dish in Switzerland is the cheese fondue. And that's great. You can get really crushed on white wine eating cheese fondue.
What is fondue? Just heat it up in a dish?
Well, you take a bunch of usually it's three different types of cheese, and it depends on the region of Switzerland or the France along in the Alps. They're regional cheeses. It usually has Gruyere, which is the most prevalent cheese in this country.
Right.
Emmentaler, which is the cheese with the holes in it. And it could be Appenzeller. I like Appenzeller. That's a region of Switzerland, where Appenzeller cheese is made, and you shred all those, and then you heat up some white wine, and you take one clove of garlic first, split it, and rub it all inside the fondue pot. Now the fondue pot is a porcelain, steel porcelain coated pot. With a handle, and they rub the garlic in there, and then they'll pour some Riesling, which is like a fruity flavor, not a dry white wine, but a fruitier white wine, and They heat that up. Then they take the cheese and you stir in a figure eight pattern, not just in a circle because that will clump up the cheese. You stir in a figure eight pattern, slowly trickling the cheese in there. And then once it's all blended and it starts to bubble, then you throw a shot of Kirsch. That's a cherry liqueur, schnapps. It's not sweet. It's like moonshine, but it's made with cherries. And throw a shot of that in there, finish that off, and then you take day-old, like French bread chunks, and they're in about inch and a half squares. And they have these long forks with two prongs on it, and you put a piece of bread on that, and then you take it, the bread, and you dunk it in this melty cheese. And that pot is placed on a little like a mini Bunsen burner. It's got a little heat, like a candle that keeps things hot so it doesn't, you know, cool off. And you get your cheese, you twirl it, and then you eat it. And then you drink white wine with that. And it's very important when you do that to also, at the end of the meal, drink some tea so you don't have a big cheese ball in your stomach and you're constipated for 2 days. 2 weeks, whatever it comes to.
but tea will do that?
Tea is warm. It breaks it up, breaks the cheese up. Yes, it does. And boy, is that's a fun party. A cheese fondue and you get two or three fondue pots and, dozen people around the table. And if you happen to lose your bread in the cheese, you got to buy a round. You got to buy a round for the table. So there are different rules. But that's the main one. And it's a lot of fun, though. Fondue parties, and everybody's talking and carrying on and getting lit as the night goes on. It's really great. I highly recommend. And you can buy fondue pots, Bed Bath & Beyond or whatever. You know, they still sell them, and it's very cool.
Here's another question. Mac, is there a picture of Kim in his orange jumpsuit with his cowboy hat on? I've never seen one.
Well, I lost the jump. I had it all the way up to the flood. And it happened to be packed in the basement, and I didn't get it out. And when I held it up, it just fell apart in shreds. But I will search. I know somebody's got. I'll call my friend Mooks, but I'm pretty sure I have a picture somewhere, and I'll get it to you so you can post it.
What'd you say?
What, Beth? Oh, but yeah, it's somewhere. I know it is.
You don't have a picture of it though.
I don't think I do. I'll look through the archives, but I don't think so.
Oh, you have archives.
But I know my friend Michael does, who I ran out of money with in Switzerland the first time, who went to work at the bakery. I know he does.
All right. Well, that's at some point you need to get us that, get us a picture of that. And so we can, so we can see it. Because can you imagine being, you know, some kind of like, Very, very, you know, mundane, European person going up to the Alps to, to go have a nice weekend. And then you, first thing you see when you get off the train is this kook with an orange jumpsuit and,
cowboy hat.
And a cowboy hat with the American flag on it. Okay, like, I don't.
I had the flag was on the back of the jumpsuit.
Right, right. Okay, look, I don't know that much about American cowboys, but I'm not sure they look like that.
I bought the jumpsuit in a flea market in San Jose, California in about 1965, I think. And I wore it all the time. It was just so liberating. To just have a flight suit on and nothing else.
Where'd the cowboy hat come from? You're not a cowboy.
Oh, well, David was. When I went to Victorville to see him, he had cancer.
Victorville.
And Victorville, California. And his family had a guest ranch there. And that's a whole nother story. But when I was out there, I bought a cowboy hat, a real Stetson, and then I took it back to Europe with me. I loved it. It was great.
Do you think most people can relate to how free young people used to be? How free young people used to be relative to hitchhiking and just the things that they were able to do, you know, hitchhike from one side of the country to another. I don't know that young people, if you told them, like, this is how you used to do it, they would look at you and think, you got to be kidding me.
You're crazy.
Right.
Yeah.
No, that's what I think.
What if some murderer picked you up? Man, I had a routine when I hitchhiked. First of all, I didn't dress like a bum. And I stood up, and I always, you know, had my thumb out, and I was doing some kooky gesture or something when the car went by, and I tried to have eye contact with the driver and smiling, and they'd go by. And even in Europe with my orange flight suit and my whatever I had on my head the first time, I couldn't get a ride in Europe, in southern Spain or Italy, but I could sure get rides in northern Europe. And the thing about hitchhiking is you have to, if somebody picks you up, you don't get in the car and fall asleep, because they'll open the door and kick you out. You have to converse. Sometimes you have to help drive, and you carry on conversation. Then you learn about people that way. But back then, it was easy to hitchhike. People stopped for everybody.
Yeah, everybody.
They don't do it today.
But everybody did it though, right?
Absolutely. I hitchhiked across the country about three different times, both ways. And
you'd see kids hitchhiking to school, right? They knew, like, people going that way, right? You'd see them standing on the corner with their thumb out. I mean, when was the last time you saw somebody hitchhiking?
Oh, geez.
Not too
long ago.
Yeah, well, let me tell you.
They were standing in the right place, on the on-ramp, just getting onto the interstate. But and he didn't look so bad, but...
But now, you know, people are like, oh, my God. But back in the day, man, there was hitchhikers everywhere, and you'd see them And they range from, you know, kids, young kids hitchhiking across the country to guys looking for work that were hitchhiking across the country. And it was simply an acceptable way to get around. And you saw it on off ramps to the interstate and the highways and whatnot. Got their sign out there and where they were headed.
And that's right. You had to have a sign. You had to have a sign. Where are you going?
Funny.
Yep.
Funny. All right, sir. Any big plans for the weekend now that your weather's so beautiful?
Well, I don't know. I'm going to take my wife to lunch wherever she wants to go. I think she has a place in mind. And then there's all kinds of baseball and basketball and hockey on. It's great. Sports is full tilt boogie right now, baby.
Yeah, this time of year, Patrick, he's dealing with life as an East Coast sports watcher, which means you can't watch, you can only watch East Coast sports, because otherwise it's too late. You're not liking it.
Oh, God.
Yeah, you're not liking it.
Yeah.
So I was asking him, somebody's seventh game the other night, I said, hey, did you watch that? He's like, no, it's too late. I had to go to bed, bro. He's like, yeah. I can't stay up till 1 a.m. watching sports. I said, why not? He's like, because I got to go to work.
Watched that 4 overtime game the other night, 5, and watched the whole damn thing. I said, how did you do it? I couldn't go to sleep. It was so exciting,
like a soap opera. Yeah, that was a basketball game, right? Portland and somebody else.
Portland and
Rocket. Wait a minute. Portland
and Denver.
Denver Nuggets.
No, I watched it too. I was like, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah, that was great.
And I don't watch too much basketball, so anyway. All right, well look, you have a great weekend. And thank you for the Kim Holmes history lesson.
Well, that's my pleasure. We have Beth bought a Mexican cookbook the other day from Cooks Illustrated.
Your favorite magazine, exactly.
For the All Marine Radio magazine.
There you go.
Mexican flavors, and it's Cooks Illustrated, and there are spectacular recipes in there, and I'm sure we'll try some, and we'll get into it next weekend.
Okay, all right, looking forward to it. One of our favorite kinds of food, and that is
I can eat it every day.
all things Mexican. All right, man, have a great one.
You too.
There you have it. The one and only. All right. There you have it. The one and only Pete Kimball Holmes on a, I'd never heard that whole story. So, that was awesome. That'll do it. A reminder, if you haven't done so already, download the 3 Goals and 8 Commandments of Post-Traumatic Winning. Keep them on your phone. Change somebody's life. All right? Do that. Honestly, I say this all the time, but I can't say it enough. On a daily basis, I have people that reach out to me and talk to me about the impact it's had on them. And so, do it yourself. Just take those goals and commandments, and all you have to do. The conversation starts with, hey, you got a minute to talk? And when they say yeah, and then you get them to a quiet place, you just say, you know there's nothing wrong with you, right? And they'll look at you, and then you'll have their attention. And then you can tell the tale of a post-traumatic winning, which is, you know, the lessons drawn from our culture. So, and you can change somebody's life. So do that. And that's what this song always reminds me of now. It is absolutely within our power to live better lives, to change the lives of others. And we need to do that. So do that. Don't forget, write it on your forehead. Tune in Monday. General, Lieutenant General Paul Van Riper, United States Marine Corps retired, joins us for the first installment of a series called On Discipline. And I'll tell you right now, the interview is a great interview. So on a Friday, have a great weekend. All Marine Radio, over and out.